want the Republicans to wake up is the Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
This program is supported by listeners. My thanks to Larry Duers, who has exiled himself to Costa Rica. And he contributes every month to support the Peter B. Collins Show. Thank you, Larry. Coming up later in this podcast, Dave Berman will join us, an activist, citizen journalist, an advocacy journalist advocate. How's that work? He's got a new book out called We Do Not Consent, Volume 2. We'll talk about that and about his new website at manifestpositivity.org. But first, working on the question posed by Springsteen here. Who will be the last to die for the mistakes of the Bush administration, the insertion of American forces into Afghanistan without a clear mission, without an exit strategy? And we still have over 130,000 American uniformed service members in Iraq, and that doesn't even count in either case the military contractors who expand our presence by a significant factor. Norman Solomon is a media reform advocate. He is the executive director of the Institute for Public Accuracy. He has traveled to war zones in the past, including to fact-finding missions to Iran, to Iraq, and he most recently returned from Afghanistan. He is also the author of a number of books and the documentary film based on a book called War Made Easy. And he is an expert in understanding the history of how we get sold on a war and get stuck with it. And, Norman, I welcome you back to our program today.
Hey, thanks, Peter.
Tell us, just give us a baseline report here and take, as long as you need here. There's no commercial break coming up. Tell us why you went to Afghanistan, who you went with, and what you found.
Well, I went to Afghanistan. I was on the ground 5 days in Kabul in late August and the beginning of September here of 2009 because I believe that unfiltered information is absolutely crucial, both for members of Congress and the public at large. If we're going to understand what is going on, in this case in Afghanistan, what the U.S. role is and could be, and what we should do as people in the U.S. in terms of speaking out on policy and hopefully in a democratic process affecting policy. And so the purpose was really to open up those channels of communication more. And I should say that initially a member of Congress was scheduled to go in our delegation, and then two staff members from the U.S. House of Representatives. And the auspices of the trip were the Institute for Public Accuracy, which is a nonprofit organization where I'm executive director. So as it turned out, the people who went on the trip were myself and Rick Reyes, and it's quite an appropriate touch that we were listening to the song a few minutes ago, you know, Who Will Be the Last to Die for a Mistake, because Rick Reyes, as a U.S. Marine who was sent into Afghanistan in the autumn of 2001, and then into Iraq, posed just that question with a conscious echo to the chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, John Kerry, when Kerry was chairing a hearing where Rick testified back in April. And actually, there is a video of Rick Reyes's testimony on YouTube, and anybody can just go Rick Reyes, and there it is.
Mm-hmm.
For 6 minutes, he laid out how he changed his outlook as a gung-ho Marine fighting in and supportive of the war in Afghanistan and Iraq. This was here in late summer 2009, Rick's first return to Afghanistan since the time half a dozen years and more ago when he was there carrying an AK-47. And the net result of the intervening years is that Rick has come to really fundamentally question the premise of what he calls the U.S. occupation of Afghanistan. So we went, and we went unembedded, and we were able to meet a lot of Afghans and Americans and internationals, U.N. officials and others, during those 5 days.
And is there any story as to why the congressional staffers and a member ultimately did not go?
Well, the story on why the member of Congress didn't go was that the State Department said it was too dangerous for a member of Congress to go. And
really?
So he changed his mind.
Without a Blackwater escort, is that it?
Well, yeah, you know, there is that sort of binary category. Either you go as what they call a CODEL or a U.S. congressional delegation, and then you're sort of behind U.S. military lines and, as you say, contractor lines as well. And sort of the bargain, if I can call it that, I don't know exactly what to call it, the deal is that if you go as a CODEL, as an official congressional delegation, then you are protected. And you also have almost nothing to say about where you go and who you see and who you talk to. And so it's, frankly, a very circumscribed, some would call it sort of the dog and pony tour. Then there's the other option, which is to go the way that our organization, the Institute for Public Accuracy, organized and implemented this trip. And that was to go independently, to seek out a wide array of people, to not feel restricted except by trying to be careful so that we wouldn't be in undue jeopardy. And those seem to be the choices.
Mm-hmm. And do you think if you'd added a golf outing in Scotland on the way that a member of Congress might actually have come?
Well, I think the member of Congress we were dealing with, it wouldn't have mattered. But I have to say, quite a few members of Congress, that might have been the tipping point.
So tell us what you found, Norman, particularly in Kabul, which has been the scene of many rather brazen attacks on the Ministry of Justice. And with the election that was underway, or the, I guess, the vote count was still in progress while you were there. Serious allegations, very serious, credible allegations of fraud. In some places, the tabulated vote for Karzai was 10 times as many as the total voter count, the registration count in that particular precinct, or however they break it down there. So tell us what the mood was and how much tension there was with concern about some sort of an attack in broad daylight.
Yeah, well, as you say, we were there after the election day, and so I think we were there, so to speak, during the vote counting or the vote not counting in terms of how certain ballots apparently were cast aside and some were sort of manufactured. I saw and heard from people just enormous skepticism and disrespect for the government, which wasn't necessarily there 6 months or a year ago. It was known the Karzai government was corrupt and is corrupt. It was known that it was and is fairly inept. But the new wrinkle now, it's also illegitimate because of the brazen way in which Karzai's allies have stuffed ballot boxes, skewed the counting, and so forth. Several months ago, it was believed that Kabul, which is where we were during our 5 days in Afghanistan, was a pretty safe place for Americans, certainly compared to most of the rest of the country. But in the last few months, that has shifted. And as you note, Peter, there have been bombings. There have been some really horrible events there in the last several weeks. And Election Day, that was part of a pattern around the country. As a matter of fact, one journalist informed me that Election Day, which is to say August 20th, 2009, was the day of the most attacks ever by the Taliban since it fell from power in late 2001. There were 600 different attacks around the country on one day, and I've come to think of it as kind of a mini Tet, referring to the Tet Offensive in Vietnam that shattered the illusion that the incumbent, established, U.S.-supported and backed, propped-up government was really in control. I mean, if the capital of the country can't defend itself against attacks and it can be bombed at will, essentially, by the insurgent forces, then that tells you something about how credible the tales being spun in Washington are about the notion that, hey, you know, this war has a U.S. ally government in command and control. That doesn't seem to be the case. I saw just on so many blocks, you could just drive almost randomly, and on a lot of blocks there were guys carrying AK-47s, there were flatbed trucks, occasionally, not so often, with machine guns mounted, and what was striking to me as the presence of these weapons on the street were two facets. One is the way that they were being held. You know, sometimes people are holding rifles or guns or whatever, and they're just sort of being cradled or they're being held by the side and pointing at the ground or whatever. No, these were basically being held at the ready for use at a split-second moment's notice, which to me indicates the tension level. And the other is that this was not just a phenomenon on the streets. As a matter of fact, I went to buildings that house the offices of United Nations agencies, the World Bank, Afghan government, American NGOs, non-governmental organizations, Afghan non-governmental organizations, a woman's consciousness-raising and entrepreneurial training group. All of these places I just mentioned were guarded by men with these guns.
Now, Norman, describe for me the array of armed opposition to the U.S. occupiers and the Karzai government, because we have a shorthand that is developed in the media in this country that they're all referred to as Taliban. And there is a Taliban, and I'm not in denial about that. But there are many other groups who are aligned with various warlords, and there are subgroups, Lashkar-e-Taiba, many others, that have bases in Pakistan and also have links to people on the ground in Afghanistan. And I think one of the big failings of our media and our political leaders is to define the various facets of the opposition there, because we're led to believe that the Taliban is almost, you know, a uniformed militia group that can be easily identified and that is one cohesive, unified organization.
Well, I agree with you, and that shorthand is very misleading when we think, gee, it's the U.S. and its allies against the Taliban. In fact, it's the U.S. and its allies against the insurgency, and sometimes the U.S. allies were U.S. Enemies and vice versa 5-10 years ago. In this case, yes, you do have the Taliban, and it's hard to tell how united even they are when they would legitimately be called that. But for instance, you have this reality that is known as the Haqqani Network, which is both operating in Pakistan and Afghanistan. And one of the striking things to me about the Haqqani Network, now father and son led, is that it got enormous support from the U.S. and its allies in previous decades. And they're very ideological, extreme Islamic fundamentalists, most brutal tactics, so brutal that even Mullah Omar is said to have criticized the extremity of their gruesome executions and beheading and so forth. Well, they were nurtured by the good old USA, Saudi, Pakistani, ISI intelligence agency connections. And then you also have this guy, Hekmatyar, who ever since the 1980s was, for a long time anyway, a strong favorite of the Saudi Arabian government and the United States. And this guy was always a horrific misogynist, mass murderer, violator of human rights, as one could possibly imagine in that context. And yet, He kept switching sides, and now he is aligned with the Taliban, although he's not part of it. And I find it stunning. You know, it's that saying that history isn't over. It's past, and it's not past at the same time. And nowhere could you find that more true than in Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm. Norman, describe the visibility of the U.S. military presence. And I realize there are other forces there as well, but the Germans and the British are really taking a back seat. The U.S. is in the driver's seat here. And the illusion is created that over some period of time, that there is a government structure that we can work with to build on and expand, that there is an army and police force that can be trained and ultimately would be capable of defending that huge and very, very difficult to occupy country because of the terrain. And describe the visibility of the U.S. presence and the reactions or perceptions that you picked up from the various people that you talked with while you were in Afghanistan.
Well, in Kabul, I saw just some presence of U.S. military in terms of some armored vehicles and small convoys that would be rumbling through the streets from time to time. I saw more of the Afghan army there with a lot of their trucks and, occasional flatbed truck with a machine gun and the bullets, belts of bullets streaming in the wind and so forth. And I understand that the U.S. troop level, according to accounts, are now 60,000 in Afghanistan, scheduled to get up to 68,000, that being U.S., and then another, and I don't know the current exact figure, but what is it, 40,000 or more non-U.S., but so-called allied or under U.N. umbrella, not peacekeeping troops in any meaningful sense of the term, but other military forces that are in the country. And then we learn in accounts such as in the New York Times about a week ago that the number of U.S. paid contractors is actually even more than that 60,000 figure. So it's a way of, I think of it as sort of a, in a grim way, a hamburger helper enterprise to expand the impact and the reach of the U.S. military per se. And so I suspect that the real visibility, which I did not see, would be in places like Helmand Province in the south, where the U.S. is really, to the delight of the likes of, say, Anderson Cooper on CNN, they're out doing their big military show, and they're in there fighting.
About the time that you were there, and you can specify whether this occurred while you were visiting or not, but there was yet another loss of life. Large numbers of civilians were killed. This is a somewhat unusual case because German forces asked for a supportive airstrike, and a couple of fuel trucks, tanker trucks, were blown up, and this caused a significant, I believe, 70 or more civilians lost their lives. Did that occur while you were there, and what did you pick up in terms of General McChrystal's reaction?
That happened a couple of days after we left. We left the first day of September, and I think it's a notable, a horrific event that is notable also in context, because it was a few weeks ago when General McChrystal announced this new policy that the U.S. would not strike when it would endanger civilians. And I was talking about that with some independent journalists, and therein hangs a tale, in Kabul, associated with the Institute for War and Peace Reporting. It's very tough to be an independent journalist in Afghanistan. I talked to one journalist whose brother is now in prison because of his own reporting about the drug corruption of many Karzai allies, including President Karzai's brother, Wali Karzai, who's head of the Provincial Council in southern Afghanistan. And when I was talking to one of those independent journalists, this subject came up of McChrystal's announcement of a new policy, and he said, yeah, what about what just happened with U.S. forces rampaging through a hospital in search of, they thought, Taliban, and terribly treating some of the staffers and patients there. This had not hit the news at that point, but there has been, you know, a modicum of publicity in the U.S. press here in the last few days about it. And so I heard some skepticism about this sort of supposed new set of rules of engagement, and then this terrible event that you referred to around those two tankers where many civilians were killed. And so I think, frankly, it's part of a sort of a public diplomacy PR whistles, bells and whistles effort by the Obama administration, putting the Pentagon up front to say, oh, no, we're not going to do it the way we did before. Well, civilians not only have continued to die, but when you're fighting this sort of counterinsurgency campaign, you can't pour 500,000 troops into the country. As an American society and government occupying or at least engaged in a long-term military presence in another country where there's so much opposition to your presence, you rely on what you have come to in a grotesque way love, and that is high technology means of killing. And so this is very much the case. You know, this is the way it's going to be done. There will be troops on the ground, but there will be use of this weaponry that's from the air as well.
And Norman, do you see any prospect that the U.S. as an occupying force, even over a long period of time, let's say 10 years, can really build credibility with the resident population and displace the Taliban in any meaningful way? And I'm using Taliban as an umbrella term for the various groups that we described.
Yeah.
But it strikes me that if I live in Helmand province or in Kandahar, and even if I don't like the Taliban and I object to the repressive nature of their government in the 90s, if I'm given a choice of aligning with the occupiers and being a marked man who would be, the score would be settled at some point, either while the occupation continues or after it ends, then how can we ever hope to persuade people to trust us over these indigenous forces who are ruthless and who will exact retribution for those who are seen as quislings?
Yeah, I don't know, because Afghanistan, more than almost any country I can think of, has experienced in the last three decades so much of a set of twists and turns as somebody's in power and somebody else, and this warlord comes in and then that one and the other. So naturally people are in a state of protracted shock, perhaps, or at least they've seen so much violence, suffering, uncertainty, and a daily life in jeopardy that it's hard to know how this will go. It's hard for me to believe that at best, from the Pentagon vantage point, the U.S. can do anything more than create, to use Walter Cronkite's 1968 term about Vietnam, a bloody stalemate. Because, as you mentioned, the country is just so vast, it's mountainous, it's never had a centralized government tradition, and it's tribal. It's hard to see how the U.S. presence will do anything more than prolong the war. My sense is, from polling and just the people I was able to talk to, including about 40 students in a class where people spoke English at Kabul University, and they were asked by me and my colleagues I was traveling with a series of intensive sort of polling questions, that the vast majority of the Afghans, from what I can tell, do not want more U.S. troops sent in. And the vast majority are angry and upset about the killing of civilians by the United States. The vast majority, or at least a majority, do not want the U.S. to simply disappear overnight. And there's been this recurring trauma, I think, first at the beginning of the 1990s, then about 6 or 7 years ago, of seeing the U.S. disappear quickly and a feeling of abandonment. And that issue of abandonment has been sort of reframed by the U.S. news media and by some in the U.S. government to say, oh, we must not abandon them, we must keep bombing them, as though that were the only two alternatives. And I think really a key to this is development aid. When you have 90% of the U.S. spending in Afghanistan going for military uses, then what's left over for humanitarian aid is even worse than 10%, because a lot of that is frankly being recycled back to contractors, companies, NGOs, and private firms with headquarters in the good old USA. So very little of that one-tenth of a loaf is getting to the Afghan people. It's not much more than a bunch of crumbs.
Norman, one of the issues of great sensitivity, which will be cynically used against those of us who are calling for a rational policy in Afghanistan, is the plight of women. If we were to leave and the Taliban resumes control of the nation of Afghanistan. I recently spoke to Colonel Ann Wright, who is a hero of mine. She resigned from her State Department post in Kabul during the invasion of Iraq in protest. And she is an advocate for women in the military, fighting back against sexual assault and rape. And she is also, I think, a worldwide advocate for peace. And she cares a lot about women in Afghanistan and the whole thing that is symbolized by burqas. But the repression is very real. And we see even today that it's controversial whether females should even go to school. And so one of the Hobson's choices that we face now that we're there is that if we leave, there is a certain heightened risk to the female population of that country. Yet net-net, I make the argument that our occupation is untenable and that we're not only killing women and children right now, we're killing their men as well. And that that is a greater evil than should we depart. There certainly is great risk and a high probability that women will once again be severely discriminated against. How do you weigh those factors? And do you agree with me that the Obama administration will use this as an excuse to maintain or increase U.S. troop levels in Afghanistan?
Well, it was used as an argument by the Bush administration, the George W. Bush administration, initially for invading Afghanistan. Certainly after the presence was there, it was sort of a self-congratulations by the administration, you know, the big defender of women. Several aspects come to mind. One is that it's not just the Taliban that is a force for repression of women in Afghanistan. There are other major players and warlords who are also misogynists, who also exert power that is very negative towards women. I met with Malala Joya, who became well known. She's now 31 years old, became well known half a dozen years ago when, as an elected member of the new Afghan parliament, she denounced the warlords and advocated for women to such an extent that she has undergone 5 assassination attempts, and I had to visit her essentially in what was a clandestine, undisclosed location with a lot of armed guards around her. And she makes the outspoken point that there are a lot of anti-women forces, the Taliban being just one of them. Another aspect is that when you ratchet up the violence of war and the tension, it is bad for women, not only because, as statistics tell us, that women and children often bear the brunt of war, not only because the maternal death rate and the infant mortality rate is now among the highest in the world in Afghanistan, and that war is certainly a contributor to that terrible circumstance, but also because even in a situation inside the home, which no legislation, no occupying army can really affect, we have tremendous repression of women. I spoke to a women's empowerment group and UN officials with UNIFEM, the organization based in Kabul, the branch there, and it was cited for me a study that found 89% of Afghan women being subjected to very serious domestic violence, more than being slapped around, which is bad enough, 89%. So how could we assume that by ratcheting up and escalating the war, we're going to help that figure come down? On the contrary, it's going to go up. So the notion, the assumption that war is going to liberate women, I think is mistaken.
Yeah. Norman, I want to read to you a paragraph here that was emailed to me, and this originated from Professor Michael Brenner, a professor of international affairs at the University of Pittsburgh. And it's a quick summation of the mess there that we face. He writes, here is the more complex reality. The Taliban agenda is an Afghan one or a Pakistani one. Their credo and program sets no ambitions beyond its borders. No Taliban has ever been implicated in actions outside his homeland. Today, their movement is fueled by a Pashtun sectarianism, aggrieved by a government in Kabul, dominated by their traditional Tajik and Uzbek rivals, whom we installed in power, except for Karzai, our guy, himself a Pashtun. The Taliban's political neutering is therefore an impossibility. Fellow Pashtuns in northwest Pakistan are pushed into the Taliban fold by American airstrikes that enrage tribes whose members are victims, often innocent ones, as occurred last Thursday near Kunduz, we discussed a moment ago. And he says, parenthetically, that strategy is the supposed invention of Stanley McChrystal, who previously was best known for his term as commander of Camp Cropper, where the torture of Iraqis was institutionalized in May 2003. Our prodding of the Pakistani leadership to abandon their policy of containment for one of military intrusions in conjunction with American airstrikes has led to unprecedented upheaval that is further destabilizing that country's royal politics. The Islamabad political elite are no more ready to risk civil war by complying with American demands than is Mr. Karzai to kowtow to Richard Holbrook at the risk of his political future. Do you have a comment on his analysis?
Well, I think it's well put. And part of the conundrum and really the horrible dilemma for people in Afghanistan is that in the current vote counting or vote stuffing or non-voting counting of the post-election period, you have basically Hamid Karzai and his nearest rival, Abdullah, who is himself part of, one of his parents is a Tajik, and he comes out of the leadership of the martyred guerrilla leader Massoud. Well, Abdullah is somebody who was involved in the carnage in Kabul between 1992 and 1996 that ended with the Taliban taking the capital city, but in the interim, during those 4 years, meant the killing of about 65,000 residents of that city. And so he is hated because by some, including Pashtuns, because he has so much blood on his hands. And then Karzai, one of his big boosters in the closing part of the campaign, was General Dostum, the Uzbek warlord, who also has tremendous human rights violations and blood on his hands. Yeah. So questions of human rights and legitimacy are really so serious that the factional issues of Pashtuns and non-Pashtuns, it is that irony that the Karzai government, to keep itself going, has not only tried to join itself at the hip as convenient to the White House, but also to some of the northern ethnic groups, non-Pashtun. And this is a game that I cannot see a good outcome to in the next few years. All these supposed smart guys out of Washington, D.C., who think they have this gone in a good direction, frankly, Peter, I believe the walls are coming down on this edifice for war planning and war making. Or to switch metaphors, I think the wheels are gradually coming off the U.S. policy there, and Obama keeps kicking the can down the road, but he can do that just so much.
Yeah. Well, and Norman, as we're speaking here in this first full week of September, we're seeing a few cracks develop. Speaker Pelosi has piped up and said that, and this appears to be in anticipation of a request from Republican Defense Secretary Gates for more U.S. troops in Afghanistan. She seems to be drawing a line, saying that she doesn't believe that the American public or the members of the House are prepared to support a call for more troops. And even John Murtha, the congressman from Pennsylvania, who is, in my view, quite corrupt and in the pocket of military and other defense contractors, he has spoken up, raising questions. And he was instrumental in leading some of the opposition back in 2004 and 2005 to both the surge and the extended U.S. occupation of Iraq. So I don't count him out as a voice on these issues. And so it does appear that Democratic leaders are listening to some extent to the commentary provided by people like you and me and other progressives who have raised these issues in a very forceful way. Do you see that the honeymoon for Obama is starting to wind down, and that even Democrats, and I do want to add Russ Feingold to the mix, because he really a few weeks back started to raise these serious questions about what our strategy is, and most importantly, that we don't have an exit strategy. So do you see political forces building that will make it more difficult for President Obama to expand U.S. presence in Afghanistan?
Well, I think definitely in many ways across much of the board, the honeymoon is over for Obama, and that certainly includes, among the prime examples, the escalation of the war in Afghanistan. There's a tremendous push-pull and some internal tensions that are huge inside Democratic delegations to the House and Senate, particularly in the House, where there's more at least openness to being independent at times, about this escalation. And, you know, the supplemental appropriations got through ultimately with only 30 anti-war Democrats voting against it. Now, as I understand it, it's going to go to the regular budgeting process, but still, then it will come up. Will the U.S. House and Senate continue to vote for more funding of this war? And I think it's going to be increasingly difficult for the White House to keep those votes in their column on this. But, you know, there's the flip side where having a Democrat in the White House, being a Democrat in Congress, there are enormous ways that the arms can be twisted. And to just sort of backpedal to big picture here, 2010 isn't that far away. I start to believe there's a chance that Democrats could lose control of the House. It's certainly not impossible. And so this call for solidarity, to use the term, between Democrats in Congress and a Democratic president, you can bet that Rahm Emanuel will play that card all he can, and some Democrats will cave. I hope they don't, because sooner or later, there needs to be an end to this escalation and the beginning of a timeline for U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan in tandem with an escalation of funding for humanitarian aid and development.
Norman, I want to get your thoughts on the domestic battle over health care, but before we move on from Afghanistan, I just want to ask if there's anything that we haven't covered that you'd like our listeners to know that you observed on your fact-finding mission.
Well, one point I'd make is that my visit underscored the importance of the gap between the Progressive Caucus of Congress position on aid ratios and the Obama administration. Last spring, which is to say a few months ago, the Progressive Caucus presented a report to President Obama after a series of forums about Afghanistan, saying that U.S. spending in Afghanistan should be 20% military and 80% non-military. When President Obama responded with a supplemental package that he pushed through, that package had 90% military and 10% non-military. And that, I think, approximately describes the gap between a constructive approach and the one that is being pursued by the Obama administration. It's the gap between 20% military and 90% military. And as long as this administration is more interested in paying money for destruction than in helping people in Afghanistan, the situation is going to get worse.
And I just want to add that while I'm encouraged that Pelosi and Murtha and Feingold have started to articulate objections to further escalation in Afghanistan, we're a far cry from a call to end our presence there and to bring our troops home.
Yeah.
And so we've got a lot of work to do on this issue, and it's going to be a long struggle. And I hope that like-minded individuals will keep this issue front and center because it plays to the advantage of the administration to keep it off our radar and to focus the fight on, you know, loonies who call the president a liar and sideshows like that.
And I'll mention as we move on from the Afghanistan topic that the trip I was describing to Afghanistan, it was sponsored by the group where I'm executive director, the Institute for Public Accuracy. And if people want to be able to look at our ongoing news releases on this subject, you're invited to the web. Our website is simply accuracy.org.
Okay, accuracy.org. So, Norman, you and other members of Progressive Democrats of America have been trying to frame the issues as health care, not warfare, and I think that's an appropriate way to talk about the priorities. Before I ask you to comment on the president's speech and the status of the bills in Congress, I want to talk a little bit about Van Jones, because I believe that the way the Obama administration caved in to Glenn Beck and to Americans for Prosperity on their sliming of Van Jones over his signing of a 9/11 petition and he called Republicans who were blocking climate change legislation assholes, and then he called himself an asshole. I haven't seen the tape of that, but I know that that is the accurate account. That seems self-canceling in my scorekeeping. But to allow these trivial issues and what I see as a partly race-driven vendetta by Glenn Beck, this was payback for the boycott of his television show, the advertiser boycott, that was led by Color of Change, an organization that Van Jones founded. We really see that this was a struggle about President Obama himself.
Yeah.
And that by sacrificing Van Jones and permitting him to resign over the long Labor Day weekend, that they have set the stage, I fear, for a one-term presidency for Barack Obama. Because everything is being dominated, by the language and framing of the extreme right. And we know, I just did a podcast yesterday identifying these groups like American for Prosperity and where they get their cash and how their operatives are formerly connected to Jack Abramoff and Tom DeLay. This is not some accidental confluence of forces. And the administration acts as if they're oblivious to it. Obama is, you know, in one breath absorbing an attack from this guy Joe Wilson calling him a liar, and then in the next breath reaching out to Republicans who are never going to support any Democratic health care reform whatsoever. It's ludicrous.
Well, these attacks are going to happen. You know, there's always going to be a Fox News, and if there isn't someone named Glenn Beck, there's going to be dozens of others using these corporate and right-wing vehicles of various sorts to make these attacks. So that's a given. It's a permanent part of the landscape, I'm sorry to say. What is a variable is how this Democratic Party administration in the White House is going to respond. And it's symptomatic, I think, of the way this has developed. And I have to say, I was an elected Obama delegate. I was glad he defeated McCain. But it is symptomatic that the effort is almost reflexively to move partway towards Republican positions, being the nice guy, the conciliator. And we're seeing where that's getting him. It's getting him more and more tangled up in frames of reference that are not advantageous to a progressive agenda or even the electoral success of the Democratic Party. I think this is wrong, wrong, wrong in terms of Obama trying to conciliate with forces that should not be conciliated, and throwing Van Jones overboard is just another aspect of that being replicated on issue after issue and conflict after conflict. And frankly, it doesn't speak well of staff work and thoroughness. You know, when you appoint somebody to any visible position, and that certainly includes the Van Jones position, it doesn't matter that he didn't require congressional Senate confirmation. You do your research, you go to Google, you read the East Bay Express, and you see what kind of coverage he got in his home turf of East Bay, Oakland area of the San Francisco Bay Area. And you do the research, and, you know, then you decide before you appoint him if you're going to stand by him. And if you're not going to stand by him, don't appoint him. And if you appoint him, stand by him.
Yeah. Well, and that set the stage for the president's Wednesday night speech, where I differ from many Democrats who viewed it as a game changer. Some people called it a home run, hit it out of the park. And, you know, I grant that Obama is an excellent speaker. And I think that he was in salesman mode and trying very hard. But fundamentally, I saw a man who was on the defensive, who spent a good part of that speech denying the lies of the right. And this ties right into the machinery, the media machinery that we just discussed. And that, in part, the loss of that struggle to Glenn Beck and these murky corporate funded entities set the stage for further cave-ins. And so while he went on at some length about the public option, which I consider to be a very weak substitute for single payer legislation, and it still is not well defined and is something that can be attacked and redefined by its opponents. But he basically talked about it in a positive way, and then just immediately said, "But you know, I'm not going to fight to the death over this." He didn't issue any kind of a veto threat. He didn't say that it must be in the bill. He just said that he favors it. And then later in the speech, he, once again, negotiating with himself, offered a fig leaf or some sort of olive branch to the right on tort reform. And I acknowledge that there are some issues there, but, the cost of malpractice and the cost of defensive medical techniques, is not a driver of either the lack of coverage for 46 million Americans or the annual escalation in the cost of health insurance and the underlying services that are covered. And so he once again, before we're even at the final stage of negotiating, before there is even a clear piece of legislation to negotiate from, he is giving things away to the mob on the right.
Yeah. Well, I think the question of whether it's a strong solution for the country being public option is an apt metaphor. If you look at the Medicare for All solution as the really strong substantive solution, then you look at the so-called public option as it has been floated the past many months as a sort of a watered-down version. And then you look at Obama, so to speak, continuing to water down his proposals month by month in the last several months to the point that what's left, I just don't see any point in it. I just do not see how the current Obama position on so-called health care reform ultimately improves the situation. What it gives with one hand, it takes away with the other in terms of deals with the pharmaceutical industry. It's absolutely a giveaway in a massive sense that will terribly damage our capacity to provide health care to people.
Well, and there's so many things that are incomplete, and I fault the Democrats for allowing this process to get this far without a defined package. Obama gave this speech where he repeatedly said, my plan. He doesn't have a plan. Yeah. There is no package that is the Obama plan.
Even now.
Yeah. And so, that doesn't add up. It creates a new target for the right to call him a liar. And then, all of this focus on pre-existing conditions. There is broad consensus. Even Republicans will accept and embrace the idea of removing those clauses that deny people coverage for pre-existing conditions. But they don't talk about the terms of what might occur. I cannot be denied coverage, but it doesn't mean that they can't price gouge me for coverage that relates to a pre-existing condition. So the holes in this, the unanswered questions, the unaddressed aspects of this, and to me, the fundamental failure to show us a path forward that lowers the cost of health care, lowers the annual increases, and makes insurance affordable for people to actually observe this mandate that they're going to impose.
Well, I'm totally opposed to mandates. A study just came out from Steffi Wohlhandler, the researcher and a physician in Boston, and she shows that the mandate experience in Massachusetts has not reduced the number of uninsured. And I really objected to President Obama's analogy in his speech between mandates for car drivers to get insurance and mandates for people to get health insurance. Pardon me, but some people go out on the road, they choose to drive. Okay, maybe they should have insurance. Maybe they should be compelled to get insurance. But if you breathe, therefore, you have to scrape together the money to, if you can, if you're low income, get the most substandard coverage. And it is the worst coverage that's the cheapest coverage, which is what poor people can afford. So I just find that whole mandate scenario to be very galling.
Well, let me jump in, because the only way I can accept a mandate, because I do understand that when you look at pooling in order to spread risk, that we would be better off if everybody were covered. But the only way that we can have a mandate that is both moral and practically enforceable is if we provide coverage for people who are in between Medicaid and commercial insurance carriers.
Yeah, but even then, Medicaid is substandard coverage, as we find in California with Medi-Cal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and I could see the need for improvements there. But fundamentally, I could only support mandates if we address the fact that many people can't afford to observe those mandates because
yeah.
there is no control on cost escalation. And, it you know, when I look at the 46 million uninsured, my belief is that the bulk of those are people who are uninsured because they can't afford it. And that's the area that's not being addressed, as these mandates will deliver tens of millions of new customers at price gouging rates to the commercial insurance carriers.
Right. And it will be a multi-tier system and will be, by definition, very unfair and as far from egalitarian as we might be able to imagine, perhaps, in our society.
Now, Norman, are we moving in the direction here that echoes some of the Nudnik Republicans, that a bad bill is worse than no bill at all?
I'm very pessimistic. I believe that what is likely, the way things are going, what is likely to come out as a consensus bill that would go to the House and Senate in the same form, I don't see it as any better than right now.
Well, I wish I could muster some compelling arguments against that.
Yeah, me too.
Well, Norman, anything you'd like to add before we wrap up?
I want to ask people to support the Peter B. Collins Show and podcast.
Okay. Norman, great to talk with you. Thanks for your report on Afghanistan and your continuing advocacy on important issues like health care.
Hey, thank you, Peter.
Norman Solomon here on the Peter B. Collins Show. The Peter B. Collins Show is sponsored by our friends at the Organic Wine Company. We get a small commission when you make a purchase. Now that you're eating organic, it's time to drink organic. Try the fine, earth-friendly wines imported by the Organic Wine Company since 1980. Just click on the link on my homepage at peterbcollins.com and check out the special introductory offer for Peter B. Collins Show listeners. And their website is ecowine.com.
Just a dream. Were you so confused? Was it just a giant leap of logic?
Our music of the moment from Down Under, that's Midnight Oil.
Was it the time of year?
And Peter Garrett has hung up his rock and roll shoes. He's now the Minister for the Environment in Australia. And did I hear you say? Dave Berman returns to our program today. I first met him when we did a remote broadcast in Eureka a few years ago when we had the syndicated daily radio show. He's an advocacy journalist, an activist, and a guy whose brain I really admire. He's got a new book out called We Do Not Consent, Volume 2. Dave, welcome back to the PBC show.
Thank you, Peter. It's good to be here, and we miss having you on the air up in Humboldt.
Well, thank you. I miss it, and I think of well, people like my favorite caller, Dave, who used to... now I'm blocking on his last name, begins with a G. He used to call almost every day. And Alice, his elderly neighbor, who was a voice of reason from our elders. And a lot of great people. And many have continued to connect up to the podcast and offer their support in various ways. And I'll always have fond memories of being on the air every day in Eureka.
Well, hopefully being back on the air every day is something that will be part of your future. In the meantime, it's been great to hear the podcasts, and the people who you're attracting as guests are, you know, just the same high caliber as always. So it's good work you're doing.
Well, thank you. And as to getting back on the air, I don't know that I ever will. Things have changed. The media and commercial radio in particular are really hostile to thoughtful programs and to shows that don't just engage in name-calling and shouting. And the other piece of it is that I largely blame Air America, but the idea of progressive talk as a viable business in the radio industry hasn't really panned out. And so the reason I pulled the plug on my show is that I looked at the future, and I couldn't see a path to really reaching a national audience, because over the last couple of years, we have lost radio stations that carried progressive programming and gained very few new ones.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I think that really ties in perfectly to why I've always been what I call an advocacy journalist, and mm-hmm. that is that progressive change is not going to be a byproduct of a for-profit media venture. So if we're going to use media as part of our strategy for change, the change part needs to be the top goal, the top mm-hmm. priority. Mm-hmm. And if we do that right, then we'll see how to turn that into something that makes money, because everybody's going to want to be a part of it simply as an effective means of change. And so that's where I've been with advocacy journalism, and now transitioning from focusing mainly on what I'm out there doing and writing about it. ManifestPositivity.org is a video platform mm-hmm. and is allowing me to get involved with other progressive community organizations, many of which are apolitical, and working with them on marketing and media strategies to try to create change. And you know, the idea of advocacy journalism is, presenting that and promoting that mm-hmm. in and of itself is one of the top goals of what I'm doing.
Yeah. And I really applaud your evolution, because you've done a lot of great work on basic democracy, on the integrity of elections. And rather than become the proverbial one-note samba, you have decided to not jettison that or abandon that work, but to move on from it. To broaden your horizons and to do other things. And you and I spoke before we started recording here, and I believe that you're properly attuned to the current era, because I don't think that confrontation with the man, whoever the man happens to be, is going to get us that far. There's a time for it. There's a place for speaking loudly and righteously and demanding our rights. But many people they're not drawn to that sort of a movement. And we saw that despite the widespread objection to the Bush administration, and in particular the war in Iraq, that after Bush invaded, it was very difficult to get meaningful demonstrations in large numbers. Most Americans were either afraid or, they had their own reasons for not participating. But I think that building new movements around a positive message and personal accomplishments on goals that go beyond getting a big screen TV and a fancy car, that is an appropriate mode for the current zeitgeist. Tell me what you think.
That's been my point of view for years. And so I've worked from that place, coming from that direction with the means and the tools that I've had, which has primarily been community organizing and writing about that through blogging. And then each of my past two blogs have resulted in books, just kind of spun off as a way to transition to the next thing. So that's what I've done again here now mm-hmm. with We Do Not Consent Volume 2, building a bridge from the We Do Not Consent blog to the new ManifestPositivity.org site, where what I'm hoping to accomplish is putting on display many examples of advocacy journalism leading to the creation of change, and the collected set of those videos helping to pave the way for doing this exact same approach on an even higher level, mm-hmm. which would be an online TV talk show.
Mm-hmm. Well, and also, Dave Berman, there is a gentleman named David Matheson, who has published a book. It's essentially a how-to guide, but it's aimed at progressives, and it's called Be the Media. Mm-hmm. And I take his message to heart, and what I'm doing with this podcast is saying that I've got something to say. I've got people who want to hear it. And I'm not going to rely on corporate gatekeepers and the commercial media to deliver those messages. And this has been liberating in many respects because I don't have to work on a clock. I don't have to run commercials that are either counterintuitive or directly contradictory to the themes of my views and my message. And I've already reconnected with many of the people who are podcasting my radio show, and I see great potential to go well beyond that. Every day I get an email from somebody who said, just found you at iTunes. Where'd you come from?
30-year overnight success story.
Yeah. And that is extremely rewarding.
Yeah.
And I want to take this opportunity to share with you and those listening that I have accepted an invitation from my neighbor down the hall here in the building that houses my secret studio. Larry, the lawyer, came to me about a month ago, and he said, Peter, why don't we do a cable TV show? And I said, come on, Larry, Wayne's World's already been done. And he said, no, because here in Marin County, just north of San Francisco, where I live and work, we rely on San Francisco media. There's a local newspaper that's a rag, and there is no real coverage of local issues, the local political figures, and the, you know, ups and downs, ins and outs of how our taxpayer dollars are spent. So later this fall, Larry and I are going to embark on a new cable TV show. We have a community media center here that was set up, and it's paid for by Comcast in a settlement of some lawsuits and licensing issues with them that took a long time to resolve. But we are going to be our local media, and we're going to use the facilities here for community local access. And we're also going to take the shows that originate on cable and podcast them on my website, Larry's website, and anywhere else we can put them. But I'm embracing this on many levels because I think the real future is, as you point out, advocacy journalism, not just this idea of he said, she said, and here's what the police said, but to really take subjects that we care about and cover them in an expansive way that also does reflect a serious and thoughtful point of view. And so I think you and I are in sync in a whole lot of ways.
Well, that's very exciting news, and thank you for doing that, and thank you for sharing that with me. Media needs to be used by citizens as a tool. I mean, first of all, we own the airwaves. Mm-hmm. And so it's a problem that corporations have been given control over them. And now, essentially, they use media against us. Everybody knows what I mean when I say weapons of mass deception. So it's time that we take that recognition of weapons of mass deception and be ruthlessly honest with ourselves. That means we have consistency between the way we say we see something and the way we act with that same information. And so if we're recognizing that we are being subjected to weapons of mass deception, we need to protect and defend ourselves from that weapon. And we need to turn it around and make it into a tool in our toolbox for creating change. Mm-hmm. So it sounds like that's what you are talking about doing with Larry the Lawyer, and it's absolutely what I've been trying to do all along and now feel even more empowered to do by moving from a medium primarily of writing and into video. Mm-hmm.
Well, and I don't see that what Larry and I are going to do will ever rise to the audience levels that the Fox News Channel has.
Mm-hmm.
But we can't sit idly by and just allow them to dominate and poison whatever dialogue exists in this country. And at some point, people with their remotes can say, do I want to listen to Glenn Beck spin and lie and offer really negative, destructive messages? Or do I want to see what these guys, I don't even know who Larry the Lawyer is, but, you know, what do they have to say? And are they presenting issues that really affect me personally here where I live? And I think that as we see newspapers decline, and not that local television was ever a credible source of news, but What it was 20 years ago is light years ahead of what it is today. And so there is this room for citizen journalists, for advocacy from average citizens. I mean, Larry's never been behind a microphone or behind a camera, but he's a smart guy who cares. And he knows a lot about how government works, about how the courts work, and how politics works. And so, you know, do we need to defer to the overpaid big hair pundits on national cable? Or can we just say, well, you know, they're entitled to their free speech, and we, too, are entitled to ours?
Well, like you said about the David Matheson book, which I'm also in the process of reading, it's called Be the Media. So Larry doesn't need that experience from his past. He just needs to begin, as does, you know, everybody who is interested in creating change. You find what you have the means to do. You know, I've long been an advocate for the least you can do philosophy. I think one of the reasons why social change efforts in the Bush era were not successful is a strategic thing, when really all we had in our arsenal was to try to put tons and tons of people on the street. We were at zero and trying to get to 100 all in one leap. And as we saw, that really wasn't effective. And so one of the strategies that emerged for me looking at that and wondering what would be better was to identify the least you can do and commit to doing at least that much. Mm-hmm. And I've discovered that by sticking to that philosophy and accomplishing a series of smaller things, what happens is my least consistently increased. You know, I went from just sending email announcements with news articles to having an actual subscription list, and then subscribers said, well, why don't we build an archive website? And now 7 years later, there's nearly 7,000 articles at govworld.org. And then that wasn't enough, and so I had to start blogging, and then the blog turned into a book, and the book turned into another website, and now I'm on my third one and talking about a television show, and I've been on your show a bunch of times. And to me, this was all incremental, and it all followed naturally, and it is part and parcel of a whole series of interrelated ideas that go beyond, you know, the book We Do Not Consent, Volume 2, is a collection of essays that have appeared previously on my last blog. But the book itself as a whole is so much more than that. Mm-hmm. It is collectively an example of advocacy journalism, and it contains within it certain pieces, like an introduction and a conclusion, that build a bridge to the new site, Manifest mm-hmm. Positivity. And also a part of that bridge is a glossary that defines terms like the least you can do, what would be better, ruthless honesty, advocacy journalism. A lot of the phrases that we've used mm-hmm. so far in this interview are part of that glossary. Mm-hmm. And so,
tell people how they can get the book, Dave.
The book is available at manifestpositivity.org. You can download a free PDF copy of it, or use the PayPal button and purchase a paperback. Mm-hmm. And so the work of the new site, manifestpositivity.org, and the talk show that it wants to become, it's taking advocacy journalism, hopefully, to a new level, setting an example, putting it into use through new technology means that I'm actually, you know, still in the process of exploring. I don't know exactly how to do what it is that I'm describing to people. And everybody who hears me describe it is like, oh, that should be doable. Mm-hmm. So let me tell you and see what you think. Everybody knows what Skype is. So you can have a one-on-one video phone call. Well, instead of one-on-one, I want to have it like a party line. So mm-hmm. we could have, say, up to six people, and we can present all of their images on screen at once, like the Brady Bunch,
right,
and then be able to stream live the conversation, the video and audio mm-hmm. that is coming from those people. And it would be, it would therefore be possible to not need a single host studio location, and I wouldn't need to have co-hosts committed to appearing with me every single day. I could have rotating co-hosts. Mm-hmm. And so we'd probably have two or three of us with a possibility of up to six. That means we could have one or two guests, and we could mm-hmm. have audience members, you mm-hmm. know, like call in on a regular radio show, but it would right. be adding their video feed to it. Mm-hmm. And so right now, that's what I'm imagining for how to do this talk show, which of course would then also be archived for download. Mm-hmm. And everybody, I get it. Yeah, that sounds so cool. Wow. What do you mean there's no way to do that? Well, can you tell me a website that offers a service that would allow me to do it, or people who I might be able to work with to develop something that's close?
Yeah. OOVOO.
I've looked at that.
OOVOO.com. I think you can do up to six simultaneous video feeds.
With a live stream of it?
I think you would then have to stream it separately. I haven't drilled down into OOVOO far enough to know. But I used it a couple of times, and it was really cool.
Yeah, I looked at that. I remember you had mentioned it to me once before. I've been doing a lot of research about different technology sites and just putting the word out to people who are more connected to cutting-edge technology than me, because I need to attract collaborators to make all this happen. And so I'm just putting out there what it is that I'm imagining doing, how I'd like to approach it. Of course, I'm not married to the technology approach I've just described at all.
I think it's a hybrid of OOVOO and Ustream.
Right.
Ustream.tv is a free streaming service. I don't think they have the video conferencing offering. So if you somehow plug them together, jumper cables.
Right. That's kind of the exploration process that I'm going through right now. And to what end? Well, it's so that we can take all these ideas that are, say, in the glossary at manifestpositivity.org and in the book We Do Not Consent, Volume 2, and basically be doing field tests of these ideas. These are strategies for change and communication theories, and we're out in the world testing them out. Mm-hmm. And we make videos that are online that people can see and be inspired by and submit their own, and we're just doing advocacy journalism to see if, in fact, we can create the change that we want to see in the world. And if it is, you know, if they're effective, if these strategies work and we create change, that is what will be the hallmark of success of advocacy journalism. It's not about ratings, audience size, advertising dollars. It's just about, is this more effective as a way to create change than the unsuccessful attempts to put, you know, hundreds of thousands of people in the streets to stop a war, which we saw didn't work.
Well, and I particularly, there are a couple of things that give me great encouragement. One is the huge numbers of people of all ages who are using their computers to look at video. And it's not just YouTube. And it's not just, you know, catching up with the Daily Show clip that you missed. It is very broad-based. And as I said, demographically, it goes well beyond the young people who populate MySpace and Facebook. And so that is very encouraging. And the other part is that more and more people are just totally disgusted with what is in the commercial media. And they're checking out. They've got a big screen TV, but they use TiVo to filter out what they see and fast forward through the junk, including commercials. And they also are using satellite TV and the new distribution via telephone lines that also comes into your computer. So that we have a breakdown of the corporate stranglehold on video delivery in this country. And what we need to do is improve the content so that, you know, and I'm not making fun of people who put up their dog videos or, you know, silly stuff at YouTube. That's fine. It's personal expression. But what I want to see is these channels used to develop new networks so that we can reach people who want to hear the kinds of messages that you're talking about at Manifest Positivity, and where you're really trying to promote thoughtful, positive approaches to the problems that we face, and in a way that's different from the conflict-driven media that most people are used to.
Yeah, that's right on. That's a perfect encapsulation of what I see as happening and why I think this is an approach worth taking.
Mm-hmm. Now, Dave, I want to credit you because you have provoked me on several occasions.
Non-confrontationally, apparently.
You have provoked me to think about ideas in different ways, and to also either refine or modify my own thinking. And one is in your overarching concept of we do not consent. And I think that you reframed a number of issues into this mode, that we look at them in terms of, well, wait a minute, we're supposed to have a choice, this freedom that they tell us about that is our right as Americans, includes the right to give our consent to be governed. And you have a list here that's in Volume 2 here of items to which we must say we do not consent. The lost presumption of innocence, spying on Americans and an overall loss of privacy, government lawlessness, destruction of our environment, the promise of endless war, free speech zones, depleted uranium, which you describe as Bush's slow-motion Holocaust, government-run media, secret prisons, torture, and war crimes, and we do not consent to secret vote-counting machines. Now, I don't know if you realize this, but you have listed here the elements of fascism.
Yes, I'm aware of that.
And I, in a full-throated way, agree with you. We have not consented to fascism, but we are slipping into it. We have a creeping police state, and people are afraid of the F word, either that or it's used by the right in an incorrect way, Islamo-fascism.
Right.
But we saw it developing under Bush, and I am sad to say that in almost every respect it applies to this new Democratic Obama administration.
Right. It's not, I mean, if you understand what fascism is, it is a conglomeration of factors within society. It's not about an administration at all. It's about the corporate, military, government, media juggernaut, which is another term in the glossary. Those aspects of society work in cahoots in all fascist societies, including in present-day America. And the idea of consent, you know, the Declaration of Independence says that the just power, in other words, the legitimacy of government, derives only from the consent of the governed. And so it's not just that our consent has not been granted. What's happened is that our consent has been assumed and taken for granted. And so even more than saying to everyone that we ought to say we do not consent, what we really need to do is actually withdraw the consent and, even more importantly, the complicity. Because when we go along, what happens is we are allowing that assumption of our consent to continue, and we are contributing to many of the things that do us harm. And so if we become more aware, more conscious, more present with what it is that is not right, that we want to see happen differently, we can build parallels, build this movement of what we do want, mm-hmm. and therefore actually withdraw both our consent and our complicity. And do this all, like you said, non-confrontationally. We need to be coming from a place of love and not anger. And that's not some new age thing. I mean, this is stuff we heard from Gandhi and Martin Luther King. And, you know, I hear it from Michael Fronte from Spearhead, and looking forward to Power to the Peaceful this weekend.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I'm not, I mean, some of these ideas are my own, and some are inspired by some great people who've come before me, mm-hmm. and it's all coming together now at manifestpositivity.org, and it needs to have participation from people. It's not meant to be a host or a content provider and an audience.
Mm-hmm.
It's meant to be a collaborative community that emerges.
Yeah. Well, and that's the other aspect that I see about my new online mode here, is that there is there's much richer opportunity for interactivity. And I want to invite people listening to this right now to visit Dave's website, manifestpositivity.org, and get involved and send him an email. Let him know what you think about it. Give him ideas on subjects or issues that you would like to see covered. Individuals or groups who you know who are doing good work and deserve to get wider exposure. That's exactly what Dave wants to do. So don't just sit back and listen to this and say, oh, I was really inspired by Dave Berman. That's not enough.
Well, specifically, you know, do advocacy journalism. I want to promote that approach itself. So if you're working for change, you're probably making videos and putting them on YouTube and doing other things that involve media. You're being an advocacy journalist already, mm-hmm. maybe just not applying that label to it.
And I want to put out a request right here because many people know I'm doing a podcast series with Sibel Edmonds called Boiling Frogs. And Sibel recently emailed and said, Peter, are there any good new political satire songs out there? And I said, you know, I used to get three a week when Bush was in office. And it's been really, really quiet. I think that left lawn is applied to some of our very talented and outspoken artists. So if you're a musician, if you've done a parody song or a video mashup that is very timely and political, I don't care what the point of view is. I'd like to see it or hear it. And you can drop it to me, peter@peterbcollins.com. Dave, one of the other things that I want to credit you for was the frame related to election integrity of no confidence. And, you know, we've been trying to get the officials to recognize the serious vulnerabilities and weaknesses of electronic voting machines. And we have seen in very sharp relief the problems with stolen elections at the presidential level and even down to the level in Puma County, Arizona, where they stole an election about a transit tax. And yet most people are kind of numbed to this. We're currently, we just talked to Norman Solomon in the preceding segment about the election fraud in Afghanistan, which is very apparent and very widespread. But people's tolerance for this has grown. And because so many people got the result that they wanted out of the 2008 presidential campaign, people sat back and said, well, who cares about the machines? We got the result we wanted. But as you have put it, we have no more confidence that the election of Barack Obama was sound and credible than we do that the two selections of George W. Bush were.
And we knew that before the election, based entirely on the conditions that were in place to run the election. We've got secret corporate vote counting machines, so the people can't see how they work. They don't allow for true and proper recounts, and they often produce nonsense results, like more votes than voters. So there's not just no confidence, there's no basis for confidence, no reason to believe in the results that are reported. And that's been the case for years, and that's been the argument that I've made for years, and it's been the basis for a lot of the organizing and writing that I've done. And so there's a lot of that in the book We Do Not Consent, Volume 2, along with how I've addressed media, trying to move them along from the way that they prefer to approach covering this to how I'd rather see them approaching it. In other words, telling them what would be better.
Mm-hmm. And finally, Dave, I'd like your thoughts about the current state of affairs and what the best way to move forward is. Because in these early months of the Obama administration and Democratic one-party rule in Washington, we haven't seen much substantial difference from what we had before. And I think many people want to throw up their hands and say, well, you know, I just want to crawl into my bed and pull the covers over my head and ignore it. But there's a path forward that doesn't overly rely on government, on partisan politics, party politics. And it's not to say that we should all withdraw or stop our involvement in public affairs. But there's much more that we can do that doesn't involve supporting or opposing a certain political figure.
Right. It's I think we need to recognize what is essentially predictable and to be expected. And then it's back to being ruthlessly honest, you know. The corporate military government media juggernaut does not and never will have the interest of the public at heart. And it really never will produce policies that favor the greater good. You know, I mean, this healthcare issue wouldn't be complicated at all if we didn't have war. You know, all the money we need for healthcare and so many other things would be available if we weren't throwing it all down the war hole. So let's first just be honest about what they are doing that is, you know, to be expected at this point. And I'm not interested so much in trying to change government. I think we need to just do our thing, you know, do community organizing and recognize what would be better and how we can work together to create it. I was really impressed recently in the Eureka Times Standard daily newspaper in the town where I live. There was a guest opinion column written by somebody in the business development community who was talking about the state of Jefferson and how the California is ungovernable, and we ought to be looking at what happened with the state of Jefferson decades ago. And there's been already a lot of press about the idea of having a constitutional convention, and I'm interested in ideas like that, which set aside how things are and say, let's just completely reimagine. Because frankly, I think the nation as a whole is ungovernable. And I don't see how anybody could make an argument that it is governable in a way that meets all of our needs. And so if we're honest about that and we get past the idea of holding our breath for good government to come and take care of us all, well, then let's build the alternative. And if it means that we're not 50 United States anymore, I'm open to exploring that.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dave Berman, thank you for stopping by here at our secret studio today. It's always great to see you. I want to recommend We Do Not Consent, Volume 2, available as a free download. And that's at manifestpositivity.org. Check out that new website, too. And give Dave your feedback on what you think and how you would like to become a part of that community. Thank you, Dave.
Thank you, Peter.
Good to see you. Thanks for listening to this edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Drop me an email, peter@peterbcollins.com. Roy?
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.